next on Unsolved Mysteries. A man plans a fake kidnapping to extort a ransom. But there's a hitch. His accomplice kills him. A woman disappears. Her fiancé says that he dropped her off at a casino. But security tapes tell a different story. Two strangers, two separate car crashes. Both victims say they became psychic after their brush with death. A sheriff-turned-outlaw reportedly buries $6 million worth of gold in the Montana mountains. Many believe that it's still there.
You might have that one vital clue to help solve one of our cases. I'm Dennis Farina, and this is Unsolved Mysteries. Join us.
Littleton, Colorado. It was an ordinary Wednesday morning in the neighborhood of Roger and DJ Dean, except for the strange car parked on the street. Some remembered it was a 68 Pontiac, others a 76 Oldsmobile, but everyone agreed the man inside was a stranger. At the time, they thought nothing of it, but at the time, Roger Dean was still alive. Roger called his wife into the bedroom around 7 that morning.
Jay, come out here.
What is it, Roger?
All right, lady, shut up and get on the bed.
Oh!
Roger. Get on the bed. Shut up!
The masked intruder forced Roger to tie and blindfold his wife. Then he took Roger into another room. As DJ lay helplessly on her bed, she could hear Roger and the gunman talking, but she couldn't tell what they were saying. DJ heard the gunman rifling through drawers.
Let's go. All right, I'll give you the money.
Then, a loud noise. At the front door, he fired again, at point-blank range. Roger Dean died before help could arrive. From the beginning, several aspects of the case puzzled investigators. Roger had twine marks on only one wrist, so it appeared that he had never actually been tied up by the gunman. Also, Roger was wearing contact lenses when he was shot.
His glasses are...
Yet, strangely, in an upstairs bedroom, his glasses were found, covered with duct tape. Police believe that both the twine and the glasses were red herrings, planted to give the impression that Roger had been blindfolded and bound.
We believe that Roger hired an individual to come over to basically kidnap him, take him to his bank, withdraw $30,000 from their account, and then obviously drop Roger off someplace so Roger could report a robbery, and he would have that $30,000 to himself.
During the investigation, police also learned that Roger had taken nearly $30,000 from his business and put it in a secret account. On most weekdays, Roger left home before 6:15 a.m. On the day of his murder, he was seen drinking coffee in his garage at 7 a.m.
What we make of that timing is that he was waiting for this individual to come and meet him at his house. We also believe that the individual was probably sitting in his car when Roger lifted the garage door, which was a signal for this individual to get out of his car and walk over to Roger's home.
In my heart, I cannot believe that Roger had anything to do with this. This is the man that I was married to for 26 years, and yes, there had been personal problems in the last few years, especially since the death of our son. But I knew the man too well.
After Roger's death, DJ and her daughter Tammy tried to move on with their lives. But 5 years later, they received a chilling anonymous letter. Incredibly, its author claimed to be the man who killed Roger Dean.
The letter demanded $100,000. And if the money wasn't delivered, he threatened to kill again.
Do you know that I've met your daughter, Tammy, on a few occasions? Do not make me kill her. Your son is dead. Your husband is dead. Do not risk your daughter. She is the last one left.
I was in total shock. I mean, this was like something that doesn't happen to you. This only happens in the movies.
It makes me angry that we had just started to get on with our lives and put the past in the past, and it's all brought up to you again. You know, this person isn't letting us continue, and we never did anything to deserve this.
DJ and Tammy called the police and the FBI. They were convinced that the letter was legitimate and that it was written by Roger's killer. DJ and Tammy were given round-the-clock protection. The killer told DJ that he would call again.
Wait for the second ring now.
FBI agents moved into DJ's home and set up a wiretap.
Hello.
Listen, your husband owed me money, and I want my money.
If my husband owed you money, I'll pay you what he owed you.
The FBI traced the call to a phone booth in Denver.
I'll call you tomorrow, and I'll tell you where to take it, 7 p.m.
But when they got there, the killer was gone. The killer called 12 more times, and then he told DJ to drive to a supermarket 20 miles north of her home and wait for further instructions. DJ tried to trap the caller with the help of an FBI agent hidden in her car. Surveillance trucks and a SWAT team were nearby.
Okay, she's out of the car, and she's headed across the parking lot now. She's headed towards the phone booth.
And I waited, and I waited, and I waited. Could not believe I was really having to go through this terror.
Hello.
The extortionist finally called and told DJ to leave the $100,000 in an alley behind an apartment complex in downtown Denver. Later that evening, the FBI watched as DJ made the drive. They waited until dawn, but no one showed up.
Whether or not he spotted something, whether or not he just took for granted that the law enforcement was involved, or whether or not he got cold feet, and although he didn't detect any type of law enforcement, he just was too scared to actually make the pickup. I think all those are possibilities.
When he didn't pick it up, I was devastated, because I thought, this is not over.
Hello?
There's nothing more that either one of us want than for this to be solved.
And now I'm gonna hurt you.
He's still terrorizing us. He is still making us live a nightmare that continues on and on all the time.
In his last call, the extortionist told Tammy he planned to kill her. He said he would strike when she least expected it. Update. There are new developments in this case, and here's one of our staff with details.
In 2020, DNA evidence found on the killer's ski mask led investigators to a new suspect, Michael Jefferson. Jefferson was arrested and currently faces charges for first-degree murder and kidnapping.
Next, how could a woman disappear from a busy casino? 24-hour surveillance cameras may provide the answer. Apple Valley, California. Al Henderson and Jean Moore seem like the typical couple in love. But they spent more than a typical amount of time getting to know each other. It took Al 20 years to finally propose to Jean.
She was very happy, and we were making plans for the wedding. She got more excited about it with each passing day.
However, Jean's children weren't nearly as happy about the engagement.
The longer I knew him, the less genuine he seemed. I know he said that he loved her many times, but he also had a habit of putting her down in front of other people. And to me, that just didn't sound like love.
When your mother asks you to be nice to somebody who they like, you go along with it, even though you've tried to talk, like I did. I tried to talk my mom out of being around the guy.
A few months after the proposal, Jean and Al went on a vacation in Laughlin, Nevada, a scaled-down version of Las Vegas. It was there, a few days later, that Al reported Jean missing. No one has seen or heard from her since.
Many people, especially her children, are convinced that something bad happened to Jean and that her fiancé, Al, was somehow involved. What follows is Al's side of the story and his account of the day that Jean disappeared.
According to Al, they were just about to check out of their hotel when Jean wanted to play her lucky slot machine just one more time. He told us that he dropped her off at a side entrance of a nearby casino and went to find a parking place.
When I did not find one, then I returned to the valet parking.
Can my wife pick up the car later? Thank you.
Got the ticket. Went inside the casino where Jean was waiting for me.
Here's the claim check for the car.
Our plan was that we would meet back at our hotel room at 11:45.
Al claims that he left Jean in the casino at around 9:30 in the morning. Once outside, he planned to take a taxi back to the hotel.
There was no cab there. So after waiting a couple of minutes and a cab didn't come, I thought, well, it would be nice. I could go play the slots with her a little bit.
But Al found somebody else playing Jean's favorite slot machine.
I felt, well, because someone was there playing it, she may have decided to go shopping or some other thing. From 10:15 to 10:15, I played the machine that she liked, hoping that she would come back and I would be able to get up and just say, here's your machine, have fun.
Can you take these bags to security? We're checking out.
Al checked out of the hotel around noon and returned to the casino to look for Jean.
When I saw that the car was right where it had been left, and I spoke to the valet, nobody had brought a ticket for the car, then I began to become alarmed.
Al says he thoroughly searched the lobby, the shops, and the gaming area, but he says he could not find Jean. Over the next few days, Al distributed thousands of these flyers in the Laughlin area. Despite a $25,000 reward, no one called.
After a certain amount of time, I had to figure that something terrible has happened.
Jean's children thought the same thing, but they are convinced that Henderson knows more than he's saying.
The more we find out about what supposedly happened as compared to what can be verified, the less I'm inclined to believe that he's telling the full truth.
In my opinion, Al has not said everything that had happened then. The reason I say that is because, number one, the story has changed a couple of times.
Al originally told police that he dropped Jean off in front of the casino and gave her the valet ticket there. But Al told us that he left Jean at a side entrance and gave her the ticket inside the casino.
Within a couple of days, or within the day, you know, I knew that he was involved. Or in my heart, I know he was involved.
Police knew the casino had surveillance cameras that monitored every square inch of the casino 24 hours a day. It was time to verify Al Henderson's story. Al had said that a valet parked his Cadillac and that he entered the casino a little after 9. Surveillance tapes confirmed this. Beyond this point, Henderson's story and the surveillance footage do not match up. This tape shows two views of the area where he says he gave Gene the valet ticket and where they supposedly walked around.
I have reviewed 4 of those tapes of the areas that Mr. Henderson said that they were in. In the tapes that I have reviewed, the surveillance tapes that I have reviewed, we do not see Jeannie in any of those tapes.
I can't really comment on that. I can only tell you what happened. I accept no responsibility for what their tapes show or don't show because I am not an expert in that field. I can just tell you what happened.
Al also said that he had waited for Jean at her favorite slot machine.
In examining the tapes for the time frame, Al gave us 9:45 to approximately 10:15. The machines that he told security was her favorite machine. We do not see Al playing those machines.
Well, the only response to that is that he was evidently looking at the tape of the wrong machine.
I have checked with the surveillance personnel for the hotel, and they have advised me that this is the group of machines that Al Henderson told the security personnel was Jeannie's favorite machine.
Investigators began to wonder if Jean had been in Laughlin at all. Eventually, they found a waitress who had served Al and Jean on the day they arrived.
Have you had any luck in the casino yet?
Other than the coffee shop, we have nobody seeing Jeannie in the Laughlin area.
How would you like your steak cooked?
The question remained. Where was Jean between the Monday sighting and Thursday when she disappeared? A few weeks later, a witness came forward with a possible answer. A friend of Jean's claimed that she saw the couple 150 miles away from Laughlin. They were at a gas station in their hometown of Apple Valley the day before Jean was reported missing.
The witness remembered the time because they were en route to a school function, and that would have been only at that time, and pinpointed the time and date.
But Al says they were both in Laughlin, and there are phone records to prove it.
I provided several people with copies of my telephone log from Call USA showing that I made a call from Laughlin to the Victorville area at a little bit after 3 on that day. I had another call, I think it was at 6:59 on that day, so you've got less than 4 hours, and it's physically impossible, even if all you did was drive from Laughlin and turn around and go back. You can't do it in less than 6 hours.
Phone records verify the calls were made from Laughlin on Wednesday. Also, Al's bookkeeper told us both he and Jean called from Laughlin the same Wednesday evening.
And so we discussed various things, and then he says, well, just a minute, Jeannie wants to say hi too. So Jeannie got on the phone, and she was just happier than happy could be, because she had run into a stroke of luck on one of the poker machines.
Less than 24 hours later, Jean Moore was reported missing.
Unequivocally, I had nothing to do with the disappearance of Jean Moore. I had offered the $25,000 reward. I think that my net worth has gone down from around $2.5 million to $1 million. If I could get her back, I'd give the whole $1 million. I would do anything to get her back.
Jean Moore's disappearance has no explanation. How could a woman simply vanish from a crowded casino in broad daylight? The family says they won't stop searching until they find the answer. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jean Moore, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Next, can a traumatic car crash trigger psychic powers? Two accident victims say yes.
Can an intense trauma trigger psychic powers that allow us to see things that others can't? John Holland and Elizabeth Joyce were nearly killed in separate car accidents, which they say left them with strange psychic gifts.
Los Angeles, California. John Holland's life is about to change forever. John was dazed, but not seriously injured. And then the following day, he began to feel strange.
I started noticing kind of like electricity building up in my body, like a, I don't want to say a power, but it was more like a surge of energy was building. I just felt that my body had too much energy in it. That's the only way I could describe it.
As a child, John was interested in psychic phenomena, but it wasn't until his accident that he knew he had a gift. At his work, he was able to predict a stranger's birthday.
It would just come out of my mouth straight out, and I had to learn how to stop that.
John says his predictions became so accurate that co-workers became frightened of him. Holland's boss eventually asked that he stop making predictions.
I'm not out to prove anything, okay? This is what happened to me, this is what comes out of me, and this is, people come back and confirm.
Car accidents and other sudden events that shake up a person's body and, of course, the inner body, called the aura, have on occasion caused that person to become psychic. There are a number of cases on record. There's also a case of a man who fell off a ladder and, as a result, became a well-known psychic.
A few years after his accident, John began seeing clients professionally. He claims his powers intensified and that he now could communicate with the dead.
A client named Adrian who came to see me, and her dad passed away, sadly. Basically, she wanted to know, where is he? What is he doing right now? So what happened, her dad came and told me to tell her to look in a book on the bookshelf.
He wants you to be at peace.
He described the bookcase, he described the location of a book, and he said, and there's gonna be something, a message from your father in this book. And I was unclear if he meant the book, and he said, no, there's a message in it, a piece of paper, a message from your father that will let you know that he's okay.
It took 2 weeks. Finally, Adrian got the courage to open the book. John was right. Inside was a poem written by her father 28 years ago. John believes that if not for the accident, he would never have known that the note was there. Saddle River, New Jersey. Elizabeth Joyce and her son Jeff were badly injured in a car accident. Elizabeth shielded Jeff from the impact, but she suffered massive injuries. On the way to the hospital, Elizabeth's heart stopped beating 3 times. And during those blackouts, she says that she was reunited with dead relatives.
On the left was my stepson, on the right was my husband. They talked to me with their mind. You have to go back, you have to go back.
Elizabeth survived the accident without any permanent physical disabilities, but she was worried about neurological damage.
I started having a tingling sensation across my shoulders and up my neck, and I started having blackouts.
Soon after the accident, Elizabeth began having the same frightening dream over and over again.
It was an explosion. I saw a house, I saw a body, I saw it go out the roof. I was aware of oil wells, I was aware of a trailer park and a fence. It was so real to me. And in my head, I would hear your aunt died. She's in Houston, Texas.
But Elizabeth didn't have an aunt who lived in Houston. After having the dream every night for 3 weeks, she told her social worker, Brenda Hayes, about it. Brenda was amazed because the home Elizabeth was describing was actually Brenda's aunt's home in Houston. And there had been an explosion there a week earlier.
There was a pipeline explosion on her property, and they haven't been able to find her body or find any remains to identify what happened to her. I started to explain to her what the setup was, and she said, no, wait, I'll draw you a picture. And it's
white. Elizabeth drew the house perfectly. She then pointed to a section of tall grass near an oil well where the body of Brenda's aunt would be found.
Jenny, it's Brenda.
The Houston police were called. Within an hour, they found a body. It was Brenda's aunt. This wouldn't be the last time Elizabeth's newly discovered powers would solve a mystery. When Exxon president Sidney J. Riso was kidnapped from his home in New York, Elizabeth Joyce had a vision. She called the police.
I'm not a fan of psychics, and I've come across many, many psychics. But in this particular case with Elizabeth Joyce, I did find her to be very, very accurate.
In black and white, I saw a blonde-haired woman in a jogging suit running behind the car, falling and screaming for help. I saw the man get out of the car to go over and help this woman. I saw a man come around from the bushes. I saw him grab this man that had gotten out of the Cadillac and put a gun to his head and force him into a white van. I knew that it was Riso.
For 6 weeks, Elizabeth talked to the FBI every day, giving them more information.
I said, they're putting him in a trunk, and they're taking him off a main road, and they're going to dig a shallow grave. And he said, describe it to me. Oh, I said, it's between two pine trees. It's in a narrow space between two pine trees, and it's off a main road, either the Garden State Parkway or the New Jersey Turnpike.
The FBI won't comment on Elizabeth's information. However, Sidney Riso's body was found exactly where she predicted.
Sidney Riso's remains were in a 3-foot-deep sandy grave in the depths of the Pine Barrens.
Elizabeth says that her information also helped catch the killers.
I don't try to ever convince anyone that there is such a thing as psychic sensitivity. I let them find it for themselves. I'm there to help others if they are open to being helped.
If I can reach one person, that it helps them change their life for the better, and they know things about themselves more, or if they know that we all go on, then I've done my job.
John Holland and Elizabeth Joyce continue to use their powers to help others. Do they really have psychic abilities? Just ask the people they've helped. They certainly think so. Coming up, innocent neighbors are caught in the crossfire when a murderous husband attacks his wife. Talladega, Alabama.
Hi, well, thanks for the ride, girl. Give me a call.
Early one evening, Geraldine George, a 36-year-old mother of two, returned home from work. She had been separated from her abusive husband, Larry George, for 6 months. Even though there was a restraining order against him, he continued to harass her. That evening, his obsession turned deadly.
Geraldine went inside her apartment and dropped her belongings off. She walked next door to Janice Morris's apartment and Ralph Swain's apartment.
Geraldine was friendly with her next-door neighbor. Janice had agreed to watch Geraldine's kids while she worked.
right, say goodbye to everyone. Never say goodbye.
She went in, sent her kids home, talked briefly with Janice. It was rather brief because Janice was on the telephone with her mother. Geraldine, after talking briefly with Janice, walked back next door, and as she entered her apartment, Larry George was already inside the apartment talking to her kids.
You know you're not supposed to be here. We've been through this before. You want me to call the police again? I want you out of my house.
I don't want those people taking care of my kids.
You don't tell me what to do anymore.
You're gonna listen to me.
Put the gun away. Honey, I want you to go upstairs. You call your granddaddy and you tell him that Larry's here. Go on. Larry, no! No!
Let go!
No!
Geraldine ran next door for help. Janice was still talking to her mother.
Please call the police. Larry's next door and he has a gun.
I heard a woman's voice yelling, Janice, Janice, call the police. So I asked Janice, who was that? She said, that girl just left out here. What's the matter? She said, I don't know.
Let me call you back, okay? Bye-bye.
And that's the last time I heard her voice.
Larry George shot Janice in the chest before she can call the police.
Larry, please stop!
Then, in front of Janice's two children, he shot Geraldine as she cowered on the floor.
What's all this noise down here? Janice!
Janice's boyfriend, Ralph Swain, heard the commotion and ran downstairs. He was shot in the back of the head. Then Larry George calmly walked out of the apartment and disappeared. Janice Morris was pronounced dead at the scene, and Ralph Swain died a short time later.
This murder was stupid. I mean, Ralph or Janice, neither one knew Larry. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Geraldine George survived the shooting, but was paralyzed from the waist down. The next day, sheriff's deputies discovered a car hidden in the bushes at a campsite 6 miles out of town. It was registered to Larry George.
He had been living in the car. There was a lot of clothing in the car. We found a notebook where it appeared that Mr. George had been keeping a diary as to who came and went at his wife's apartment and camouflage clothing.
I want Larry George to pay for what he did.
Update.
After we air this story, an Unsolved Mysteries viewer claimed to have seen Larry George fishing on the banks of a river in Delaware. Two detectives were sent to investigate.
This is where we first encountered Larry George at, right here. We began a conversation with him about fishing. And it was at this time where myself and Detective Pinkett made eye contact and identified myself as a police officer, Larry. At this time, a brief struggle ensued right about here. We all three fell to the ground here. We got back to our feet, still struggling, and at that point, we just turned and threw Larry into the water.
George tried to run, but backup units quickly cornered him. Finally, he surrendered. At George's campsite, police found a generator, a stove, a spear gun, and a sawn-off shotgun.
He knew he was wanted for murder. He wasn't going to be taken alive if he would have put himself in his hideout, and if we'd have discovered it, he probably would have had gunfire and officers would have been hurt.
7 months after his arrest, Larry George was tried and found guilty of capital murder. He was sentenced to die in the electric chair. In a moment, the story of a fortune in stolen gold hidden in the rugged hills of Montana. We recently told you the story of an escaped prisoner named Robert Gerald Watson, who had been arrested for kidnapping and rape. In Tennessee's Hamblen County Jail, Watson and two other inmates were cleaning a common room known as the Slammer. When they were done, they signaled to a nearby deputy. During the struggle, the jail's automatic outside doors opened. One of the inmates was overpowered by the deputy. A second was captured later that night. But Watson made a clean getaway. Update. Monroe County, Tennessee. A viewer tip led police to a remote area of Monroe County, where they found Robert Gerald Watson. He was charged with rape, kidnapping, and assault.
Given Mr. Watson had already been on the run for over 2 years, and we'd had no leads on him, Gerald Watson's arrest was a direct result of the Unsolved Mysteries program. When I went to Knoxville to pick Mr. Watson up to bring him back, he had made a statement to me in the car. He said, "Yeah, I seen you on TV." He said, "I knew you guys were coming down to get me."
3 months later, Watson was convicted on all charges. He was given a sentence of 10 to 25 years in prison. It was a legendary treasure buried in the Montana hills. Or so the story goes. In 1863, a crooked sheriff and his gang went to the gallows, refusing to reveal where they had hidden their stolen gold. It's a tale of murder, money, and betrayal. Bannock, Montana. When gold was discovered in Alder Gulch, Montana, hundreds of prospectors descended on the town.
Riches were being made and people wanted to get in on them. That's why there was such a large gang of outlaws around every mining camp.
Hey, fellas, we got company. What can we do for you guys?
In the spring of 1863, a group of those outlaws, known as the Road Agent Gang, nearly wiped out the prospectors. It has been said they stole more than 1,000 pounds of gold. Henry Plummer, the town sheriff, was also secretly the leader of the outlaws. Henry Plummer was an ex-convict. Ironically, he had just been released 4 years earlier from a brand new California prison, San Quentin.
Henry Plummer was a very pleasant-looking individual. He was the only man in Bannock, practically, that always tipped his hat to a lady when he saw her on the street. Well, you could call him the consummate con man of his day. So he was able to con people into thinking he was a competent man to be the sheriff. And of course, he knew that being a sheriff would give him a perfect cover.
Boys, we got a stage leaving Bannock in 2 days. It's full of gold, and I want that stage.
Plummer and his gang targeted miners trying to transport their gold to a major railhead.
Put your hands up, boys! We want the gold!
It's estimated that in 4 months, Henry Plummer and the road agents killed more than 120 miners and stole what today would be $6 million in gold. Finally, in December of 1863, the gang went too far.
Look at that, they took the hide right off of it.
A local rancher found the body and brought it into town.
And that was enough for them. They formed a posse. And during the next 6 weeks, the vigilantes worked picking people up, giving them a trial, and we know they hanged about 22 men, at least.
When the outlaws were caught, they started pointing fingers at each other. One road agent, who was about to be hanged, identified Henry Plummer as the gang's leader.
I want you all to know that Henry's the one that planned all this. He's the one that run all the road agents. He's the man you want.
The vigilante posse raced to Plummer's house. Plummer was marched to a scaffold that ironically he built himself. But before he was hanged, he made an unusual request.
Give me 2 hours and a horse, and I'll bring back my weight in gold.
You made that mistake once.
Henry Plummer died without telling anyone where the treasure was buried. Immediately after his death, prospectors started searching for Plummer's buried treasure. In the early 1900s, two mysterious gold hunters may have found it.
They went into a local store that had a vault and asked if they could leave this box in there all night. And one of the men stayed there riding shotgun on the vault. The next morning, they disappeared. Nobody knew who they were, where they went, or what they dug up.
Even if one box of Plummer's gold was found, there's probably a lot more out there. Two local men, Scott Jones and Bill Chappie, have been hunting for the treasure for years. They're confident that Plummer's gold still lies buried somewhere in the area.
Nobody would bury all their eggs in one basket. So it's understandable that he has it someplace where he has access to it. I bet there's 1,000 pounds or better in different places, maybe, from Virginia City to Banning.
Perhaps the location of Plummer's buried gold will never be found, if it was ever there at all.